Yeah, I'm probably the only 31-time world champion that cleans stalls every night. And Noel's like, "Why do you do that?" And I just go through and I'll grab the piles out of the stalls, but I just like to be around my horses. I like to, I like to just see how they're acting. I like to see if they're eating good. I like to just be around them and communicate with them. And I feel like being the best horseman I can be, that's one of the things that I enjoy the part of it. I'm kind of over, I obviously we have to win in order to stay successful and to keep the business going, but I'm like the I'd say the young surfer that's the hot dog that wins all the surfing competitions, then becomes the old guy that gets out the longboard and just surfs for the good feeling. And now I'm becoming that soul surfer pretty quick. So
You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Welcome to The Ride, a podcast brought to you by Horse and Rider Magazine, hosted by Nicole Cherico and Emily Carey.
This episode of The Ride is brought to you by Ride TV. You're going to want to watch Horse and Rider's videos on Ride TV. Watch carefully curated playlists for a variety of Western disciplines, including topics about gear, drills, mental strategies, and more. Our playlists are here for you to use to troubleshoot, progress in your goals, and improve your horsemanship. Plus, binge hundreds of hours of archived live streams, including the NRHA Derby, Mustang Challenge, RSMC Ranch Sorting World Finals, and more. Use promo code The Ride for 15% off your first month at RideTVGo.tv today. Hey there, welcome back to The Ride. This is Emily Carey, and I'm here with my co-host Nicole Cherico. And today we're joined by none other than Steve Meadows, an AQHA professional horseman, multi-carded judge, and the 2018 AQHA Most Valuable Professional. Known today for his expertise in ranch riding, Steve first made his mark in the show pen with pleasure horses, where he achieved something few ever have, winning the Western Pleasure Triple Crown in 1999, meaning he swept three of the most prestigious titles in the industry, the AQHA World Championship, the All-American Quarter Horse Congress, and a major national title, all in the same year. Since then, he's evolved with the industry, building a career that blends horsemanship, mentorship, and a serious passion for the ranch horse world. Steve, thank you so much for joining us today. We're really excited to chat with you.
Thank you all for having me today.
Yeah, so to get us started, can you tell us a little bit about your background in the horse industry? How did you get involved with quarter horses?
I grew up in the horse business. I'm a fourth generation horse trader. My great grandfather, my grandfather, and my father are all traders. My great grandfather started out with draft horses, tied head to tail, riding through the mountains of West Virginia, trading with farmers. And my grandfather started shipping what they called using horses then, would probably be a good term for ranch horses. Now is just good all around riding horses, shipping them on boxcars into West Virginia and selling them to people for riding horses. Back when a lot of those rural areas didn't still have access to roads for cars and stuff. So, and of course my dad, he married my mom and moved to Virginia, and that's where we live now. Same, I'm back on the family farm, and he traded his whole life. And as a child, I was basically a horse sale rat. I went to horse sales and I showed on the weekends. And as I got older, I realized going to the horse shows, there was a lot of cute girls there and not a lot of guys to compete against to talk to those girls. So I started showing, and of course, back then it was Western Pleasure. If you're in Western, it was either Stock Horse, which is now Reining, or Western Pleasure. So that's basically what I showed all through my childhood, and then became got discovered by a trainer that had moved back from Texas to went to work for a big farm in Virginia. And he had come to a local show to watch a relative's show and saw me on a horse, tried to buy the horse, and ended up offering me a job. And I went to, and I think this was in 1988, I went to work for a farm called Cloudcroft, which had seven stallions and about 250 brood mares, and it's probably one of the largest breeding operations in the eastern United States. And this was back before ship semen, so you know, you had a lot of, you know, each state had their own breeders programs. So I went to work there as a trainer and started showing quarter horses then. At 18 years old, I never earned an AQHA point till I was 18, and haven't looked back since.
So obviously you grew up in the horse industry, you've been around them your entire life, but you didn't actually get involved in the AQHA competition until you're 18. How was that transition, and what made you kind of stick with going in the competition route versus more of that horse trading, working horse background that your family had?
I just loved it. As a child showing, I loved it. And, it was funny because when I started taking horses and working on them and training them to be show horses, and my dad owned them, I would take them to the horse show and win with them, and my dad would sell them while I was in the arena showing. So I would have to have a young one coming on all the time. So it got to the point to where I just, you know, I really liked making the young horses and turn them into show horses. And, you know, while I was in high school, I went to school with a girl that rode hunters and did the A show hunters. And we went to school together, knew of each other, but we actually met at a horse show, and she was 15 and I was 17. And we just celebrated our 30th wedding anniversary. So, she's, but it, you know, it's just one of those things, you know, I loved showing. I loved the image of the horse trainer. I loved, you know, all the aspects of the horse show world. And, you know, and like I said, you know, when Charlie Rogers discovered me, it gave me the opportunity to, you know, to show at, you know, on that level, which, you know, that, you know, the bigger quarter horse circuits here in the East and the Congress and the World Show. So I just kind of stuck with it.
Kind of going off of that, so as you're kind of getting more involved in the bigger events, how did you, I know, like, in the time period that you're talking about, people tended to do everything. It wasn't as specialized mm-hmm. as it is today, but was there a certain event or discipline that really kind of you found yourself connecting with more than the others? Is that kind of how you transitioned more into the Western pleasure industry? How did that kind of journey begin?
Well, when I was a kid showing in the local shows, it was what, I mean, Western pleasure was it. I mean, it was it. When I went to work for Cloudcroft, we had a lot of halter stallions. We had a lot of halter babies, the big baby fraternities. I won in 1989 or 90. No, it was 1989. I won the Virginia Futurity Junior Weanling Colts, and there was like 37 horses, 37 babies in it. I mean, you know, the senior fillies would have 50 to 60 in it. You know, it was the breeders' fraternities back then were huge. We always had 2-year-old snaffle bit horses, but back then that was the king, you know, and it's just what I was exposed to. Being from the East, you know, I wasn't, you know, exposed to a lot of, you know, cattle type stuff. You know, this, a lot of the facilities in this part of the country just aren't set up to have cattle. It's actually getting better now than it ever has been, but it's been one of those things that's what I was exposed to. So that's what I went with. And, you know, and I was fortunate enough to make it through that. And, I went out on my own in 1990, and by 92, I had placed top five at the Congress in the Western Pleasure Maturity. And 93, I won the maturity at the Palomino World. And of course it just kept building from there.
Yeah. Like, who have some of your mentors been throughout this journey? Like fellow trainers, judges, or early influences? Like what core lessons did they pass along to you that you use, you know, throughout your Western Pleasure journey and now heading into the ranch world?
There hasn't been a lot. I did a lot of watching at shows, and that's where I really learned a lot. Obviously, I worked for Charlie for 2 years, Charlie Rogers, who's, you know, he's won the Congress a couple times. He's, you know, he's never really pushed it to have a huge program. He's all, you know, outside of when he was at Cloudcroft. But, you know, Charlie was a big influence on me to get me started. He let me do a lot of things on my own and let me try a lot of things and kind of trial and error. And he would tell me what looked good and what didn't. And he worked for Alex Ross. Alex was still in this area at the time, back in the, you know, those days, showing pleasure horses. So Alex was a big influence on me. Larry Little, they would help me at shows, and they were a lot of help. Dale Livingston was in this part of the country then, and Dale would work with, you know, he would see me doing something and stop me, and it just over the years, you know, when I was working for Charlie, we would go to the World Show. I would sit up at night and in the stands and watch like Bob Avila and Todd Crawford and Teddy Robinson and Benny Gutron. And I just could not get enough of watching those guys ride. And I would take things that I saw them doing and I would take it and try it. And some of it fit what I was trying to do. Some of it didn't. Later on in my career, when I worked for Cecilia Hilton, I worked for the Hilton family for about 10 years, and was still showing pleasure horses, but Casey Hinton was showing, she owned a Reining Stallion, and Casey was showing the Reining Stallion, and I had a young reiner at the time, and so I got to ride with Casey quite a bit at the World Shows, and Casey, just in those couple of weeks a year that I would get to ride with him, would totally just change my whole program. He is such a horseman, and I have a tremendous amount of respect for him. And, you know, all those things, I've just taken bits and pieces from everybody and kind of created my own style, I guess. And it's been really cool because, you know, I do live in a part of the country where I can't call somebody 3 miles away and say, hey, can I come ride with you and let you watch this? I don't have that. So, I've always had to kind of figure it out on my own and, you know, and then go to a big show and see if it's working or not.
It's so funny. We had another East Coaster on the podcast not too long ago, Matt Palmer. And it was, he kind of had similar insights when it came to, you know, sometimes it's easy to have like FOMO, as the kids call it, where, you know, in Texas, you have trainers that are just next door to each other. You can just haul down the street. Arizona, I love when I go to Arizona and I can be sitting in one arena and look across the street and see five other legendary horse trainers just out there doing their thing. And being on the East Coast, you obviously don't have that accessibility that those in Texas and Arizona do. And I feel that way. I'm in Colorado. I have to haul 45 minutes to my horse trainer. But can you kind of talk about, you know, what it's been like being on the East Coast and creating a business out there, especially in the ranch horse division, you know, as you transition over into that? Because when you think ranch horse, you don't necessarily think East Coast, but we do need those ranch horse trainers out there. We need them everywhere. And it seems that they are all in Oklahoma, Arizona, Texas.
Well, and that's a good point, because it getting started, I'll just give you the whole spiel. When I was still working for Cecilia Hilton, I remember the day that I found out about the ranch classes. And before that, I mean, I was sponsored by Sean Ryan. When most people were riding Harris's and Blue Ribbons, I was sponsored by Sean Ryan. I was riding a dark saddle with a back cinch, and I'd be the only guy in the, me and Troy Compton, John Barry would be the only guys in the finals at the World Show in, you know, in back cinches on our pleasure horses, you know. So it was kind of a hard sell for me. When I found out about the ranch, I really loved it, because I loved all things real cowboy. But there wasn't, you know, you have to kind of, when in Rome, you have to do what the Romans are doing. So I spent, you know, I made my living with the pleasure horses, but I love the Western riders. I love the Rainers, you know, but I'd kind of already, I committed to the pleasure horse background. And so I stuck with it. And it was a great career. I mean, when I worked for Cecilia, 2 years in a row, GoHorseShow.com voted my job the best job in the horse show world, as a trainer. So it was in that era, it was a very good gig, and, you know, I had a six-figure income and, you know, a lot of things, and we were, you know, winning the Congress and winning the world. And so when I started building my place here, and the ranch had just started, it was actually called Ranch Pleasure the first 3 years they had it. And that was 11, 12, and 13. It was called, it was 12, 13, and 14. It was called Ranch Pleasure. It was one class. I judged to 2013 Congress, so I didn't show in it there. And I actually, in 2013, in the middle of the year, I left the Hiltons and moved back to the facility I built here. We wanted our daughter to grow up in the valley here where we grew up, moved back to our home place. And we have a, you know, beautiful place here, and we love it here. And so, you know, Becky and I decided that we were going to give this a try. And so I started, you know, I was still riding pleasure horses, but I had a couple ranch horses I was playing with. And by 2014, I had an amateur win the Congress, and I was second in the Congress that year behind Mozon. And I was pretty good at it right off the bat. It was a hard transition for me mentally, because being from where I am and coming from the background I am, I would, you know, for the 5 years, I would win the Congress, go to the World Show, and just miss the finals by one or two places, you know. And I mean, he beat on me pretty good. And I actually got kind of paranoid at the fact that, you know, maybe I've got East Coast or Western Pleasure stamped on me, and they're not going to let me in this cowboy event. So, but I just kept plugging at it and figuring it out and getting better and trying to have better horses. And it finally, you know, 2018 was kind of the breakthrough year for me for that. So I had the Seismic Reaction horse for the Fox family in California, and Katie won the amateur that year, and I was reserve in the junior on that horse. And that was kind of the you know, broke the ice with the World Show thing and the West, you know, the West versus the East thing. So if you kind of do your math and look at the records, there's a lot of good ranch horses come out of the eastern part of the country. And I know there's a lot of people that think, oh, it's, you know, it's the ranch, it's, you know, you're supposed to be from Texas or Arizona, or, you know, New Mexico or Idaho, or, you know, a cowboy state in order to do that. And it's really just good horsemanship. And, yeah, if you use those horses right and make them you know, and create a horse that could be a good working ranch horse on any ranch, it doesn't really matter where you're from.
Well, and yeah, I think the pleasure is such a great background, or at least I think so. I came from that world as well. And it set me up for success in other industries because you truly understand body control and getting one broke and being able to do the transitions. And while I focus more on
transitions are a big thing,
you know, and while my focus was more on the pattern stuff, like all of that translated so easily when I started doing cow horse events and reining horse events. And so I do think that it is a really big game changer having all of that body control and that background. But you mentioned that you felt you would do well at the Congress, not go to the World Show and have the show that you were thinking you were going to have. Did you feel like there was a difference between how the East Coast horses were moving versus the West Coast, or was it just a mentality thing? Like, because I feel like it's like that in the pleasure world too. The Texas horses are different.
I think it was a mentality thing because, you know, there's really no set style in the ranch, you know, and that's one of the great things. And it's one of the things I teach in my clinics is, you can't put a standard on the ranch like you would the reining or the pleasure, to where most of the horses look very, very similar. You know, the same horse that you're going to see in Southern California that maybe was in a, you know, in a cow horse program and is a two rein or bridle horse is going to carry themselves very differently than a horse that's coming from, you know, is coming from Weatherford, Texas. You know, they're not going to have that same look. And so, you know, or, you know, Southern Arizona, that the style of equipment they use, you know, versus say Montana, it's not going to look the same. And, you know, so ranch kind of means something different to everybody. And I hear all the time people complaining saying, oh, we need a standard. We need a standard. But actually, we really don't, because this is keeping it big. If we put a standard on it to where only one group can win, and obviously, yes, there's a set of people around the country that have become specialty ranch trainers that are being very successful. But all of my horses have different styles, and I'll show them differently. I let the horse pick the style. You know, how he carries himself, how he, you know, how trustworthy he is, how good he is in the face, you know, how good he is in his top line, all that plays into, you know, where, what his ranch horse looks going to be. And different judges like different style horses. We just try to play the averages and hopefully end up on top.
Couldn't find the mic. We'll edit that out. So kind of reflecting back on your career, you've had so much success in both arenas. What are some of the lessons that you've learned along the way that you think are, you know, things that a lot of people would relate to as they start their career in both disciplines?
In both disciplines, I would say, you know, learn to be a business person, learn to pay attention to your business. It's very easy to get that artist mentality to where you're just so consumed with your craft that you don't pay attention to your family, your business, your you know, how you're being perceived. Those type things I think are very important. You know, finding, and we call it a balance. And you know, Becky and I've been together a long time, and she'll have to reel me back in sometimes. But you know, and it's easy to, I got a funny saying: horse trainers don't worry about money till there is none. You know, so it's one of those things you really don't pay any attention to it until it's not there. For me, it's very easy to get consumed. And obviously the horses are the good part, you know, being able to communicate with your clients and deal with the public and deal with the horse show secretaries and try to, you know, portray a good image as, you know, as a good all-around horseman. I feel like that's been the biggest thing. But, you know, I've had over the years, I've gotten more in tune with my business to kind of keep it in view and to understand that I, you know, that things aren't always, you know, when things are really good and you're making a lot of money and you're winning a lot of money and you're selling a lot of horses, it's easy to kind of get, oh, it's going to be like this forever. Yeah, it's like, I worked for Cecilia Hilton. I was making $150,000 a year. I was like, oh, this is great. This is going to last forever. It doesn't. You know, those deals, you know, everything has a shelf life, and then they start to fizzle out. And so it's been that way with, you know, with me, as I've tried to be aware of that. And at the same time, I advise a lot of people, you know, really make sure you keep the line of communication open with your clients. As far as when you're dealing with the clients, you know, when you're going and looking at horses, it's easy to go, oh man, this one's going to be great. We're going to win a lot. You know, don't overshoot yourself and make a lot of promises. And then, you know, the client spends a lot of money and the horse isn't living up to the hype and you're putting a lot of pressure on the horse. And it becomes, you know, a big negativity snowball that ends in disaster. So I'm very much a realist when it comes to almost a buzz killer when it comes to, you know, if we're winning, I'm like, you know, it's not always going to be this good. You know, we're going to do everything we can to make it this good, but there are highs and lows, and that's what makes the win so special. Because I've seen it affect a lot. You know, I've seen people come, and I've had clients that have come in and won a lot right off the bat. Then they start expecting it, and then they stop enjoying it and they start inspecting it. And so then the wins become relief, and then they're mad when they don't win. And so it's one of those things. This is a very humbling sport. So that's probably, I probably threw a lot at you there, but there's a lot of ways to answer that question.
Yeah. So talking a little bit more about the business, how did you have to restructure when you made the transition to ranch? I know, like, we've been talking a lot about, like, the different types of horses, the different types of riders. How have you had to really reevaluate and change your business strategies?
I didn't really have to do a lot of that. When we left Hilton's, I was just starting to, you know, I was taking young horses because she was raising a lot of horses that weren't making Western Pleasure horses, weren't making Western riders. I was taking them and doing the ranch with them. And like I said, I figured out pretty quickly that I was pretty good at it. And of course, back then you could take a good moving, good minded reject pleasure horse and make a ranch horse out of it. You know, in the early stages, you can't do that now. It's a little harder. I'm sure it can be done. When we left there, my wife, Becky, was still riding a lot of hunters, and I'm talking over fence hunters, and my daughter was showing over fence hunters, and Noelle was just going into high school. When we moved back here, the barn was probably 30% hunters, 40% pleasure horses, 30% ranch horses. And that was in the midsummer of 2013. By October of 2014, when I did so well at the Congress, I came home from there. I told my wife, this is all I want to do. All I want to do is ranch horses. This is it. And I said, in 5 years, I just want to be a ranch horse trainer. 2 years later, that's all I had was ranch horses. And then, in 2015, Becky got hurt. She had a three-year-old Hunter fall with her. She had a head injury, not a bad head injury. She'd had a bad head injury right before our wedding in a car accident. So and after the horse fall, they said no more jumping, no more riding actually without a helmet. And you need to stay on the ground. You don't need to be jumping. And my daughter at the time was starting to think about college. She realized as a hunter rider, if you're not a big elk rider from the hunter world, real hunter world, you're not going to get an NCEA scholarship. So I bought her Own Son of Shining Spark from a kid that had worked for Sean Flaherty. Sean had had this horse as a three-year-old. He didn't make it. He was a burnout reiner basically. And I gave him to Noelle and I said, you know, see what you can do. And she took him and she did everything with him. She ponied him. She jumped him. He just gave up. Long story short, I think 2016, she won both ranch ridings at the level one championships and turned around and was like 38 in the level one youth reign. And she was second in that with the horse. And she used those videos to get recruited into college and actually ended up riding NCEA and, you know, all 4 years, was a three-time All-American and stayed in that world as an assistant coach for a year while she was getting her master's, and then worked at Baylor for a year as a director of operations for the equestrian team in Waco, and didn't like the desk job and wanted to train horses. So now she's back here working with mom and dad. So we're pretty proud of that.
I was going to transition and talk about the training differences and how you've kind of evolved your program. But now I'm curious about what it's been like bringing your daughter into the professional world of training, because it's a total family affair over there.
Yes. It wasn't hard because she was around it. And when she was in college, she's like, I do not want to be a horse trainer. I have seen you guys, what you deal with, you know, paying the bills, dealing with people, phone ringing all hours of the night, you know, never having hardly any time to yourself. She's like, I don't want to do this. And so once she got through college and started coaching, she obviously had to become a pro again. So I started, I think 2021 was the first year I had her catch ride for me at the World Show, and she placed at the World. And the next thing I know, she's like, I really like this. She's like, I really like this. I want to get back into it. And next thing I know, she wanted me to find her a job in Texas as a reining or cow horse trainer, with a reining or cow horse trainer, and was planning on doing that. And I'm like, well, you're so good on the ranch horses, you know, why don't you go work for somebody like Bud? So I talked to Bud, and Bud's like, yeah, yeah. He's like, let me, so they talk. And that was kind of brewing. And then her mother and her talked, and the next thing I know, she's the rental property had my dad's old house. We had a rental property. Next thing I know, we're remodeling it and she's moving home. So I was happy that she was coming home. Now that the fact that I had to spend $40,000 remodeling that house and lose that income for the rental property, I wasn't real thrilled about that. But it has been a lifesaver. I had to have a hip replacement surgery this year, so she's really filled in big time for me, and has shown at some big shows and done really, really well. And the clients just love her. Her teaching is way less abrasive than mine. So, you know, all the clients would rather have her coaching them. And so I thought there would be more button heads, kind of a power struggle at first when she moved back, but She's been home a little over a year now, and it's been absolutely wonderful. She does a great job. She has her strength. She has a really nice 3-year-old that she's brought, from the ground up, and, it really has done a good job. And she has the horses she gets along with. I have the ones that I get along with, and the clients are, we have been able to be a lot more thorough in our teaching and training with having two of us here. So, and Becky, my wife, was, she's been a professional horsewoman for, several years, and has shown, and she likes the ranch, is never her greatest joy. The hunters were, that's what she grew up doing. But Becky has really found her niche when she worked for Mrs. Hilton. Mrs. Hilton paid her a lot of money to care for the horses, to keep up with, the vet work and the health and the well-being of those horses. And that's what Becky does now with the clients and the horses, and keeps them updated on what's going on, when they need, these injections are running out. She is a very, very good working relationship with one of the best vets on the planet, Kent Allen, Virginia Equine Imaging, and they have several vets that travel with the U.S. Equestrian Team. And we actually sold him a ranch horse. We've created, like you said, a family business, and we only keep 18 outside horses. I've talked to Bud many times, and he's got 60 head in the training. And I'm like, dude, he just rolls his eyes. He's like, this is absolutely, it's crazy sometimes. And I just, the way my program is set up, it's more of a customized boutique style business, where every horse and every client has an individualized program that we can get the very best out of each animal and each rider, and it really works. And it's, when Noelle and I are riding, every horse in the barn, we can be, if we start at, say 7 a.m., we're done by 3-4 o'clock, so it's a really, really a good thing, to where nobody gets burned out.
And you're the one riding the horse, so you know exactly where they're at. Yes. You know what their problems are, what they're excelling in, what you need to focus more on when they're ready to compete. I mean, you're there every day touching that horse around them, and can know exactly what's going on. So I've spoken to so many trainers, and it seems it's either the Bud, where there's 60 of them, and I don't know how he is able to do it. Logan is such a light. Yeah, I know Logan is a lifesaver, yeah. But yeah. We also talk to a lot of people who are like you, who keep a smaller business because they want to be able to be hands-on in every single animal that's on their property.
Yeah, I'm probably the only 31-time world champion that cleans stalls every night. And Noelle's like, why do you do that? And I just go through and I'll grab the piles out of the stalls, but I just like to be around my horses. I like to, I like to just see how they're acting. I like to see if they're eating good. I like to just be around them and communicate with them. And I feel like being the best horseman I can be, that's one of the things that I enjoy the part of it. I'm kind of over, obviously we have to win in order to stay successful and to keep the business going. But I'd say the young surfer that's the hot dog that wins all the surfing competitions, then becomes the old guy that gets out the longboard and just surfs for the good feeling. And now I'm becoming that soul surfer pretty quick. So
Well, and it's so funny because speaking of Bob Avila, we've mentioned him once on this podcast, but there's one thing that he said, because he was obviously a very big part of Horse and Rider throughout the years. He always said something about, like, when you're the one feeding your horse every night, you're the one cleaning their stalls, watering them, turning them out, you truly get to know them. You know if they're not eating the way they should. You know if exactly. they're not, you know, drinking the amount of water they would. It's all aspects of horsemanship that result mm-hmm. in those wins in the show pen.
Yeah. And talk about mentors. You know, Bob and I, over the last probably 15 years, we had gotten to be really, really good friends. And, you know, he's just, I read, as a young trainer, I read his book probably 20 times. And, you know, and some of the things in there still stick out in my mind. He said, you don't have to have the best truck and trailer as long as it's clean. You don't have to have the best horse, but whatever your horse you have needs to be slick and fat, you know, things like that. And it just really stuck with me. And it's funny, we lost him at the World Show last year. And the day before, well, actually the night before he passed away, I was going down to ride in the Jim Norick to school. And him and Troy Compton were standing out in front of Leslie Lang's stalls. And he was giving me a hard time about something. And I don't even remember what I said back to him, but my wife was behind me, Becky was behind me. And he asked Becky, is he always that full of himself? And, you know, that's the memory I'll keep of Bob Avila, you know, forever. But what an icon in our industry. There's nobody like him, and there'll never be nobody like him. It was really the fact that he even knew my name the first time we spoke. It was like I was meeting the president or something. So it was very cool though.
Oh, that's so special. I mean, what an influential person in this industry. But kind of like switching gears. Bactel, let's talk about your training styles. How are they different when you were training pleasure horses now versus all these ranch horses? Like, how are they different? How are they similar? I know we have rail work, pattern work, trail obstacles. How did you have to like change your training as you made that transition?
Basically, I think one of the things that has helped me, let me start with this. One of the things that's really helped me in the ranch horse event and transitions and how a horse carries himself is very important. You know, every gait is judged along with the maneuvers. So when you can ride that horse and create a better movement like you would in the pleasure, when you can create better transitions, that you can create that, you know how to get that horse to have that expression that looks like he wants to do his job. That I think has really been an advantage to me in the ranch horses. You know, I've a lot of reining horse trainers, especially in the early years, scoff at me and laugh at me. Well, not laugh at me. That was more of the pleasure horse guys. The reining horse were like, this stuff, that's easy. It's nothing to that. But when they come in with one and its head's, you know, 18 inches off the ground and it's, you know, over bridled to where its nose is almost hitting itself with its, you know, hitting his nose. They could trot 100 miles an hour and they could, you know, grab their ass and stop hard and turn around like a blur, but that's not a horse you could take out and do your job on. You know, that's not a horse, you know, in my part of the country, if that horse's head's below level and you go up one of these big long hillsides, you're going to jerk both front shoes off before you get 10 strides up the hill. And that's been one of the things, you know, I've learned really quick how a horse's balance is very important and in creating a good working ranch horse. And it's the same thing, you know, with the stop. You know, you want a horse to stop on their haunches, but you want them to get in the ground like a cow horse. You don't want them to slide like a reiner. If you're, you know, if you rope a cow and you got to stop it, you want them to get in the ground and stop that cow. It's the same thing out in the pasture. You know, if they're going to slide, you know, if their ground's a little wet, even with regular shoes on, if they tried to slide, they're going to go down. So you want a horse that's aware of where their back legs are when they go to stop. So, that, those kind of things. And like you said earlier about the body control, I think the body control was a, it was a big advantage for me to know how to use that body control. And I think, that's where a lot of the reining horse trainers have gotten better. You know, when you look at Casey Deary's horses and now a lot of the other ones too, I think he was kind of the leader in it. His horses looked balanced and they moved good as they were doing the maneuvers. You know, if you think back 10, 15 years ago, some of those gunners, it looked like two drunks in a horse suit when they were doing their slow small. You know, they were just, it was like they were pulling their back end along with their front end. And it was, it resembled a lope, but it looked, it more, looked more like a trope, you know? And, you know, an NRHA started having to hit that because it was getting that tough to where that horse needed to look cadenced and needed to look balanced, just like the all-around horses in the horsemanship now. Those horses, you know, the ones, you know, you can have the best rider in the world when that horse is doing the funky monkey, you know, underneath, it really takes away from that look. And so, you know, the balanced horse is cadenced, it carries himself. I think all that really, I think all that ties in together. I don't think I had, I like the fact, you know, I loved the pleasure when I did it, and a good pleasure horse. I still, you know, I'm getting ready to judge NSBA World to fly out tomorrow. And I'll judge a lot of Western pleasure there, and judging good pleasure horses is, it's a lot of fun. And, you know, and finding the great ones over the good ones is a lot of fun. But, you know, you go through a lot of, you know, I kind of compared some training on some pleasure horses was like trying to shove a square peg in a round hole all day. You know, it just was a hard thing to do. And the ranch has gotten, it's gotten tougher on the fact that a horse has to check more boxes. They have to move. They have to move good in all three gates. They have to be, they have to look good in all three gates, to where they're competitive. So, the details are starting to count more in that, you know, obviously the reining and the pleasure, the details are absolutely, I mean, it's, you know, you're down to, you know, you're counting hairs with those guys.
The reining is wild. Like we were just talking, I was at my trainer's, Devin Warren, and he was saying that Andrea was sitting in the center of the arena at the American Performance Horseman with a 74 before he overturned. And I'm like, holy crap, a 74 before he had even started doing anything besides stop and spin two ways.
Wow.
It's insane.
Yeah.
So kind of going, you mentioned that you're going to judge the NSBA World tomorrow. Let's mm-hmm. kind of transition over to your judging career. Obviously you're still very involved in AQHA judging, which means that you are very much still involved in the all around the pleasure, the English world, the halter, all of that, even though you're, mm-hmm. you're riding ranch horses, you're still a big part of that industry. What are you noticing in terms of trends when it comes to like people who came from the all around kind of transitioning over into that ranch stuff? I'm seeing more and more people who have their all around horses, but now they're also buying ranch horses and kind mm-hmm. of transitioning into that. Are you seeing a big group of people who are doing one event kind of starting to migrate over to the other and kind of enjoy that world?
No, yeah, I think all along, I think when it first started and it got really popular, you saw a lot of people from that used to show 30 years ago. Like when I first started, I had the 1970 Congress Queen he bought a ranch horse in Texas and brought it to me and was showing. And it was really cool because, you know, I think what the ranch discipline has done, like, yeah, I think one of y'all touched on it earlier, when before things got so specialized, the same horse that you took and showed halter in the morning, then you would show in the hunter under saddle, then you would show it in the Western Pleasure, then you'd show it in the reining, you might show it in the cutting, you know, and you don't see that anymore. I mean, everything has gotten so specialized. I think with the ranch horse division and the versatility ranch horse classes, I think you've seen that kind of that good all-around quarter horse come back full, not just quarter horse, paint, whatever, but that good all-around stock horse come back full circle to where, you know, that good horse that you can get on and do anything you want to do. And if you want to go ride and check cattle or trail ride or let the grandkids ride it in the backyard, you can. You know, it's that horse. And I feel like that's been one of the big that's one of the big pluses and one of the big attractions of the ranch horse. And I think I think Yellowstone didn't hurt it any. I think Yellowstone, coupled with COVID, actually created the perfect storm there in 2020. From mid 2020 to probably mid 2023, I've sold more horses than I have my whole life. In that what 3-year period. I mean, it was just absolutely crazy. And obviously, you know, like I said, the appeal of the ranch classes, plus the, you know, Taylor Sheridan bringing the cowboy way of life back to mainstream America, it's created, you know, it created a definitely a an advantage for us that we're already on board with that. So, you know, I can't think what else I was going to say, right? Sorry. But it's been a really, really good thing for the horse industry.
Yeah. The Yellowstone effect is very real and has been very important to our industry. I totally believe that. And in all of it, I go to the Run for a Million every year and I can't imagine, like, I was sitting next to Brad Barkemeyer before he did his draw. And he was sitting next to a couple from Wisconsin who had never met Brad Barkemeyer before, had no idea who he was, but they had watched Yellowstone and they were like, we're going to drive to Las Vegas for the Run for a Million because we just want to be a part of it. And it's so cool.
Yeah. Brad's a good guy. He don't come much nicer than him. He's a great horseman and just a really good family man and a good guy. It really is. I mean, like I said, it made cowboy cool again. You know, I didn't look like an alien walking through the airport with my cowboy hat on anymore, you know, but I've had some strange encounters over the years going to judge because I always wear my hat. I don't believe in checking it or carrying it in a can. It's funny. I've had little old ladies calling me texts, and I've had the obvious question: are you from Texas? That's the obvious question. But it really is a good time to kind of be in the Western performance horse industry, especially with the light that's been brought to our world. Even if I am just a pickleball trainer. So
pickleball only because it's super popular right now.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I get it. I grew up in the Chicago suburbs showing quarter horses and nobody understood that. And I got made fun of, and now all of them are loving Yellowstone and this and that. I'm like, no. You don't get to like
funny
this.
Funny story about that. And, coming from the pleasure horse world, y'all know I had a lot of success with the pleasure horses before I did that. So in March of 2014, I bought my very first I had a client, Maggie Belleville from Georgia, wanted to buy a nice ranch horse. So I fly to Texas. I look at horses for 3 days, and Jordan Larson was actually at the – it was his place before where Bud is now, and Jordan was there, and he had a gelding by Custom Chrome out of a Shining Spark mare that was beautiful. Palomino, dapples, golden, you know, 2.5 foot mane, just absolutely be good mover, good trotter, just a good horse. So we bought him. I had him shipped at the time. Adam Wainscott was still working for Charlie and Jason. I had Adam haul him to the Virginia, the East Coast Championship show, which was still in Lexington, Virginia. So he hauls him up there. The ranch was, you know, like I said, it had been going for a year, so it was just getting started. I go down to show this horse, and, you know, his mane's down, and I got on, you know, my shotgun cutters, and I go down, and all the pleasure guys were like, oh my God, here comes Roy Rogers riding Trigger. And for four solid days, they called me Tex, they called me John Wayne, they call me the Lone Ranger. They call me everything you could think of. I got so much. And I just took it. I'm like, you know, whatever. I love this. I'm doing it. And I did, you know, long story short, I ended up doing really well with that horse. But one of those trainers, who's, and I'm not going to mention his name. He'll know this if he ever listens to this. But last year at Camden, South Carolina, the ranch is always really big there. The cow horse classes are big too, but the ranch is always big there. And he come down, he got a ranch horse, got a brand on it, had his shotgun cutters on. He comes down, first time showing the ranch horse, you know, and he comes down and he rides up, and I ride up beside of him, and I stop and I said, you remember about 10 years ago, giving me a hard time in Lexington, Virginia with that Palomino horse, called me Roy Rogers. And he goes, yeah, I remember that. And I said, how do you like me now? So I got the last laugh on that. But boy, they had their way with me there for about 4 days.
Yeah, it's the horse world is crazy.
Yeah.
We talked about, you know, all these people now buying horses, getting into it. So kind of to wrap us up, do you have any advice for any of these new competitors, these new riders wanting to start competing, get into the ranch world? Do you have any advice for them?
It's, you know, it seems like now there's, you know, and it's not just in the ranch horses. There's so many online traders that get people. And, you know, you can, and they make these horses look so good on a video, and people will buy them and get them, and then they don't have anything near what they thought they were buying. The main thing I tell people is to find somebody or call me, and I'll know somebody in your area that can help you find a good solid horse to match your budget and your skill set and what your goals are, you know. And you don't want to go out and buy a, you know, level 4 reiner or level 4 cow or horse, you know, if you're just going to do weekend ranch shows. But, you know, at the same time, you don't want to go buy an old foot in the grave horsemanship horse either. So, you know, finding that in between, to finding that right horse so you can enjoy and either learn on, or you can get better and then move up later. I feel like that's the main thing, is just finding somebody in your area that has a good reputation that can help you get involved. And I mean, and you guys know this horse world is pretty small when you get to dealing with people. So there's always, you know, you can find out somebody's reputation pretty quickly if you do any kind of legitimate, you know, investigating at all. You can find out whether they're trustworthy or not.
Absolutely. And my tip is don't buy off of color. Don't buy a horse because it's a color.
And don't buy a baby.
I tell them my favorite color is blue, the ribbon.
Absolutely. I'm like, everybody's always like, oh, the sorrel horse. I'm like, well, some of our best reiners in the world have been sorrel horses. So
exactly. Well, the gelding, he's now a 3-time world champion. I'll have a cocktail on me. He's the very first AQHA world champion ranch trail horse. I won that in 21. And then in 23, he was the very first AQHA world champion ranch rail horse. Mm-hmm. And he's just a fat sorrel gelding, but he looks like one you could go day work on all day long, and just a good guy.
Yeah. So that's always, I've run into so many new horse owner or people who are trying to buy, and they're like, oh, but this one has such a long mane and it's so pretty and it's this and that. And I'm like, oh, well, that long mane takes a lot of maintenance. So I hope you're ready to be washing and braiding it every 5 days, because it's not going to look like that if you buy it and don't do that.
Yeah. And when you're showing, it gets tangled up in your reins constantly.
Yeah. Well, we have taken up quite a bit of your time, so I will go ahead and wrap it up. But before we say goodbye, can you let people know where they can find you on social media, follow along with your journey? I know you mentioned that you're doing clinics, so can you kind of let people know where they can get in touch if they're interested?
Yeah, definitely. Well, it's just, you know, I don't get really complicated with my social media. My daughter has started a Meadows Quarter Horses page, but you can contact me or friend me on Facebook. It's just Steve Meadows. And I think we do have an Instagram page now too. I'm not sure. I'm not the social media. That was taken from me. I don't get to do that anymore. But yeah, it's one of those things. Everything that we do, we kind of keep it goes through that Meadows Quarter Horses page now. So that's pretty much the easiest way to get in contact with us too.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on and talking with us. I truly appreciated our conversation today and learned so much. So we really appreciate you taking the time before you jet off to Tulsa.
Yep, it's going to get serious starting Thursday. So
at least you get to be in the air conditioning.
Yes, that's what I said. It'll be all air conditioning, and I'll get to sleep at night. So
perfect. Well, thank you so much. Yeah.
Thank you, guys. We'll see you.
Thank you so much to Ride TV for sponsoring this episode.
Thank you guys for tuning into the Ride Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and please be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Follow Horse and Rider Magazine on social media and find us at horseandrider.com to see all the cool things that we're up to. And if you have any comments or questions, please be sure to hit us up at horseandrider@equinenetwork.com. We want to hear from you guys. And if you like what you're listening to, please be sure to leave us a review on iTunes.